I don't know if I have the right temperament to be a landlord. I'm probably too empathetic and forgiving to be making my living off of other people struggling to maintain a place to live. But according to my expert today, it turns out that I might just be coming at it from the wrong angle. Welcome to the Just Dumb Enough podcast, a show that acknowledges no one is always an expert by dispelling misconceptions with real experts. I'm your host as always, Colton Petrie. My guest today is Janet Tonkins. Janet is known as the cash flow diva. She is a real estate developer, investor, and a hard money lender with over 100 properties across multiple states. She's with us today to help others find financial freedom through one of the more difficult seeming avenues, rental properties. Hopefully, she can save people out there from nightmares like this.
The realtor took the money and closed shop.
Let's learn real estate. Welcome to the show, Janet Tonkins.
Hi, thank you, Colton. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm so very happy to be here on this lovely Monday afternoon.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm very excited to talk with you today. Why don't you give a little bit of an introduction about who you are and what you do for the audience?
I certainly will. Hi, I am Janet Tonkins, and I'm the cash flow diva. I buy houses like other women buy shoes. And I've actually gotten into this quite by happenstance. And as a result of my parents' inability to have good credit scores and their inability to live from paycheck to paycheck and never owning anything. So, of course, you know, back in 1973, I wanted to buy my 1973 white Cougar. And I've been working at New Jersey Bell since the age of 16. So I did have the money available to me in my first cash down payment. However, due to my parents' inability to have good credit scores, I mean, that kind of left me devastated. And of course, what I decided to do at that instance is I was not going to live as my parents did from paycheck to paycheck and never owning anything. So what I was determined to do is to read every financial magazine, whether or not it was at that time, it was Money Magazine, it was Kiplinger, it was Inc. And so what that did for me is I also read a lot of the financial magazines. And so what I've read or what I determined from everything that I read was the way to wealth was through real estate investing. And so according to Andrew Carnegie at the time, 90% of all folks that earned wealth came from their assets. And if you think about it, even all of your McDonald's, your Burger Kings, and a lot of your restaurants, where do you think, even though they have the intangible assets, the tangible assets and the net real net worth come from the assets and owning things? So what I decided to do is to do what? Is to emulate success. And so what we did in with my husband and I, who I've been married 43 years, we decided to purchase our first property. So in 1987, we purchased a 3-unit property where we lived on the second floor. We had a first floor tenant, and we had a 4-bedroom on the third floor. And today you would call that house hacking. Now, I want you to pay attention because we're talking about interest rates here. In 1987, we paid $90,000 for that one property, and interest rates were 9%. However, we did not, even though we had saved 20% down payment, because we were in an urban town, we only had to put 4% down. So we put the 4% down and they paid our closing costs. And there are many first-time homeowner programs throughout the country. So you can take advantage of this as well. So we obtained that property for $90,000. held on to it because our rents were paid. And even though the taxes were high, and they still are today in New Jersey, our mortgage was covered. So we held on to that property. We sold it in 2005 for $415,000. How much did I say I paid for the property initially?
$90,000.
And then 400 and in 2005, sold it for 415. We gave the seller $15,000 in additional help, and we paid $3,000 for a brand new furnace. Now, where else can you go and you obtain and you can become wealthy or obtain financial independence and freedom? You see, my message, and I'm on a mission and a purpose right now, and particularly for women and children, to do the same thing, to let them know that they can achieve financial independence and freedom through financial investing and real estate with the right knowledge resources. So I want everybody else to build wealth, transform their families and communities, and achieve their dreams without limitations. I have changed not only the trajectory of my own family's life, but I've been able to save other families' life. I am a real estate developer. I'm a coach. I'm an investor. I'm also a hard money lender and a private money lender with over 100 properties throughout Maryland, Georgia, and New Jersey. And I'm most proud of our 74-unit apartment building that we've built from the ground up, the first African-Americans to do so in my hometown, for grandparents raising their grandchildren.
Which is fantastic. And I mean, you're kind of living most people's dream for either one reason or another, where it's like some people just dream of owning property at all. And you're like, I came from a very hard place and still managed it. You know, and from the other side, a lot of people are like, I'd love to quadruple my money. And you're like, I've done that more times than I can count at this point.
Absolutely. And what I will say, though, Holden, it's not easy. What I say to my students and everybody else, it's definitely not a get-rich-quick scheme. If you've heard what I've said, I've been in this business since 1987. And you got to remember, back in 1987, there were no, I'm on the executive board of the Baltimore Real Estate Investment Association. There were no real estate investment associations back in 1987. So we had to crawl, walk, and run, which is one of my signature speeches, because people hear the HGTVs, they hear, you have so many books now where gurus who are not really gurus, what they're actually doing is selling courses, and they're really not doing anything other than selling coaches. My people can touch, see, and feel what it is that we're doing anytime, because what I do is I invite you to come and see and touch and feel what we do.
And this is kind of an earned, you know, money difference, because sure, you could put money into a stock market account or whatever else, and over the course of 20 years, you might double your money. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you're talking about yours, you're like, yeah, you're going to put in hard work, but it's going to pay out because you put in hard work. So when you start helping people to do these same things, where is the best place to start?
Well, Baltimore is one of those areas where you can still make money in real estate. You don't necessarily have to do it in your own hometown. I have some investors from New Jersey. I have some investors from Georgia. But also, too, what you should do is you do your research or market analysis, because you might find something right in your own hometown. Right now, even in New Jersey, there are some properties, and even though, as I stated, that there are huge, the taxes on those, and some of my properties, I'm paying $7,000, $8,000, and $9,000 in taxes. But if you can find some off-market deals, for example, many of the properties that I paid for in New Jersey initially, and they're all two families, I think the most that I paid was $80,000 and $90,000. And today, those properties are worth $400,000 and $500,000. So some of the areas are Texas, some parts of Texas, some parts of Kansas, some of the areas, as I said, Baltimore, Maryland, there, Albany, Georgia, We found some gems in Albany, Georgia right now. We've done about 15 properties. My nephew goes to college in Albany, and so we were able to pick up about 10 or 15 properties in that particular area as well.
Yeah, and it's very particular. Like, just because you find something that's cheap doesn't necessarily mean it's any good. I know I had somebody say, like, oh, you can pick up an acre of land in West Virginia for $1,000. And they're like, yeah, but the problem is that it's an acre of land in West Virginia, which means it's basically worthless.
Who wants to live in absolutely West Virginia? Because you have to look at that. You have to look at the employment situation in those areas. You have to look at whether or not there's grocery stores, infrastructure, and all those things as well.
Certainly. So when you're, you know, starting to look, even if it's not close to home, how much money is like a good amount of money to start with? Like, what should you have in your account?
I would say anywhere between 25 and 50,000, but it also depends upon who you get, because you may find someone to partner with. For example, I said to you, I am a hard money and a private money lender. So you may very well be able to go in with 100% or no down payment. But initially, what our strength is, we've always had money in the game. So we would already have 25, 50, 75, or $100,000. But if you're house hacking, say you're a first time homeowner, you may be able to get away with only 5%, anywhere from 5 to 15% down. Remember, if you are a veteran, you can get away with 0% down, but you still need to have money. You need to have some reserves, because you never know what's going to happen down the road. So if you have anywhere from $25,000 to $50,000 to start, you're in a very good position.
Well, and I think that's one of those that people kind of overlook, is they're like, once I own the house, nothing could possibly go wrong.
Even in brand new houses today, because sometimes they're building them so very fast, you may have some issues. So I teach my students to always have reserves. And even when you're doing this, remember, you're doing this for rental income. The way that I teach them is, you take a portion of that cash flow, and even if you're managing the property yourself, you take that management fee, you take that vacancy fee, and you place those in reserves every single month and never touch them.
I mean, it's definitely good. It's one of those, like, I owned a place not long ago, just for me, is the place I lived in, and I replaced the HVAC system twice in 5 years.
And we did that too. That's the other thing. You have to know your contractors. That's expensive. And that, for me, I'm going to tell you, that's probably going to be one of the hardest things that you do, because I always say contractors have a shelf life. So they may very well do something great your first and your second time, and then they become all too familiar, or either they want to rush off to another job. And as you speak about HVAC, I've had the exact same thing happen when I'm wondering, okay, he's putting in my HVACs, the central air conditioning. And then when it was time, when it's summertime, and we may have done something in the winter, but when it came time to turn them on, every last one of his installations, we had issues with. So what we found out is, he was putting in used parts. So that caused an extreme. So for about 10 properties, what we had to do is replace it. So we've been in that situation. So that's why it's so very important that I say, you need to vet these contractors, and you need to vet them. You need to make sure that people that you know have utilized them. And then don't always try and go for the cheapest, because you truly get what you pay for.
Yeah, and you don't want to do that when you're talking about, you know, a six-figure investment kind of property.
Absolutely. Whether it's six figures or even right now for our $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 properties, you still want to get the best person to go in there, because you want to do is, you want to think about the long term. And typically what we do is we make sure that the electrical components, your plumbing components are up to date, your roof is up to date, because these are the things that can hit you hard. And if you once you rehab them, if you get those things right the first time, then for 5 or 10 years, you may not have any issues.
So say someone gets into this, they're doing pretty well, right? They've invested in a property or so. What is the like ideal position for an average person to be in? Should they have, you know, one extra home on the side that is an income property, or should they aim to get like, you know, 10 commercial properties under their belt?
Well, it's going to depend upon what that person needs is, what their income. Do you want to replace your income and do this full time for financial freedom, security, or perhaps you have some communities that you would like to change? And so, but I always say that everyone should have at least two properties, one that you own and then one investment property. And then that way you can sort of get a feel for whether or not this is something that you want to get into. Because trust me, dealing with tenants is not very easy, and that may not be for everybody. I mean, you have to be a psychiatrist, you have to be an educator, you have to sometimes be a doctor, you have to be a little bit of everything, and you have to be able to communicate well. You got to be an enforcer and a reinforcer as well. So if you have one, you have the other, at least one other rental property, that can determine whether or not this is something that you want to do on a long term. I have some students that they want 10 or more, and yes, that's what they've actually accomplished. Some only want one or two, but what I always do, start with the end in mind, start work backwards. So if you want to replace your income, then perhaps you will need 10. And then what do you need to make a month on that? What's your cash? And the important thing is, what cash flow would you like to replace? So if you want to make $500 on every single property, and then you want to make $5,000 a month, then that means you'll need to get that amount of property to replace your. And then I also let them know that if you don't want to be a landlord, then there are some alternative ways of financing. For instance, I also buy mortgage notes, especially when during COVID, it was extremely hard. You know, nobody was buying or selling during that particular time frame. So what I started doing is, I couldn't lend at the time, so I started buying mortgage notes. And then you have real estate investment trusts, and then Bezos has called Arrive, where he buys all sorts of properties, whether or not they're single families or multifamilies, but with as little as $100, you can become a part of his investing mechanism as well.
Interesting. Are there like, you know, large things to be aware of when you look at the difference between, you know, this very cheap entry level investing and like, you know, the very commercial investing where you're like, I'm going to own an apartment building?
Oh, absolutely. That's a big, I tell people that when it comes to development, you need to have lots of money in reserve, because what happens often with apartment buildings, you're spending money sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5 years before you actually see the fruition, or before you actually see the building, because you have to go through city council, depending upon what you want to do. And for our apartment buildings, what we do is affordable housing. But what makes the apartment buildings and the housing affordable is, I mean, the building is all the same, and you're still dealing with your contractors. You're still dealing with windows and steels and HVAC. Those prices, as a matter of fact, are the same if you're doing a market rate. So you're going to have money in reserves. You're going to have larger surveys, which you may not even have to do a survey on your single families and your lower unit apartment buildings. You're going to have to go before the planning board. You may have to have environmentals done to see whether or not the soil has anything. And as a matter of fact, what was interesting on a grandparents' apartment building, Before we could even get an approval for some HUD funding, we actually had to get permission from two Indian tribes, one in Arizona, and I think the other was in Kansas City, who probably had no earthly idea of what they were in New Jersey. But we actually had to get their permission before we could actually complete our project. So it's the little things. And so it is a lot costly. And this is not for any amateurs whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, and that's certainly something to remember is you're like, there's a lot of money that's going to be leaving your accounts before you necessarily recoup any of that.
And a funny story. So we brought my baby brother and his wife into the grandparents' housing project with us. And so they had never done any large development. So my baby brother says, "I don't think this is for us. It's been 2 years, and all we're doing is seeing money coming out of our account. We might just want to back out." So 2 years later, when this all came to fruition, he loved the big development fee that we were getting. So, oh, now we see that it was all worth it. But yes, and even when you're partner with developers, and so we partner with a large development. I mean, there are cash calls that have to be done for your portion of this. So you have to be absolutely have to be ready. And then you also have to be ready for the unexpected. We've been working on an apartment deal here in Baltimore City for over six years, and it has not come to fruition as well. We had the land, but with our partners have put up most of the money, and because there have been three different mayoral changes between that time frame, we haven't gotten final approvals as of yet. So those are things that you have to be looking at as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the same thing. Like, even say you bought a house that you're going to rent, say your down is $20,000. How much rent is it going to take before you even see $20,000 again?
Absolutely. And then you have to be so very important because everybody wants to hear all of the good part. So I would say 15 years ago, we were looking in Atlanta and this was a 100-unit building. What we did is, to show good faith, the realtor asked us to put $10,000 down. We put $20,000 down. However, we hadn't done, we weren't as savvy as we are now, and we didn't have any mentors or anything like that. But the realtor took the money and closed shop. And so my brother lost his entire life savings. He put up $20,000. And as opposed to now, we know this goes to a title company. You do not give anything to a realtor, you put everything in reserve through your title company, and then you choose the title company. You don't let anybody else do that for you. So those are some of the bad things that will have happen when you're going through your journey.
Well, and like you said, there's a psychological aspect to some of this too, because, if you're a landlord, like you're going to hear people having hard times out there. And you gotta, I don't know how you find that balance between like, hey, it's okay, this happens to everybody, and hey, I need my money.
and that really is a hard thing. I mean, but most important when it comes to that, you have to do your due diligence up front because you don't want to get a bad tenant in there because it's extremely hard to get them out. I don't care what state you're in. And the other thing is when you're investing, that's one of the things you need to determine. Is this a tenant friendly state or a landlord friendly state? So those things are very, very important. Then for me, you're going to be dealing because half of our portfolio is what we call subsidized tenants. So you're going to hear that more often from the subsidized tenants than your market rate tenants. So typically, what I try to do is you set manage and set the expectations up front. And you want to start off just like you do with your children. You kind of start off a harder And then what you can do is later on, what you can do is you can be a little softer as it goes on. And then you need to learn your tenants. Most of our tenants stay with us for 10 to 15 years because of the type of landlord that we are. This is a ministry to me too, because my thing is I try to treat tenants the way that I want to be treated. And remember, I was a tenant for a long time, so I had some good landlords and some bad landlords. So I try to emulate the good landlords. And it is a striking balance. And remember, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. And then everything is documented in detail. But I try to give my tenants that have been with me for a long time, you know, if they've gone through some hard times, then I'll work with them. But if it's a tenant that's constantly late and they've already established that pattern, and I tell them up front, before they're even moving, at the lease, at the move-in, look, I understand I'm a communicator. I understand that you may have some difficulties down the road, but since I'm a communicator, I expect you to call me and tell me that you're having issues, because if I don't hear from you by a certain time frame, your money is due between the 1st and the 5th of the month. And if I don't hear from you by the 6th of the month, then I'm down at the courthouse. But if you call me in advance and tell me, say, Miss Janet, I'm having problems, then I'll work with you.
Well, yeah, and there's a large difference between like, hey, this is the first time it's ever happened in 15 years versus, you know, it happens once every 15 months or it happens once every 15 weeks. Like, those are very different kind of tenants.
Those are very different, absolutely. And so you have to treat them accordingly.
Well, and I imagine like you get to know a lot of these people very well because, you know, you've been their landlord for a decade or 2 decades. Like, you've seen their children grow from non-existent into, you know, coming into high school kind of thing.
Absolutely right. And some of them become my children, or like my children. As a matter of fact, one of my ministries and what I do as a servant, because I am a servant of God, I have purchased bedroom sets. I give scholarships to the ones that are going off to college for the first time. You know, if some of them need, I got a call the other day, some of them need school clothing or books or things like that. I am there for them, especially my good tenants. And if they're good at the end of the year, at during Christmas time, they may get a $25 or $50 gift check. Or if they've been that good with me, I have the one lady who's never, she has cancer, and she has never been late a day in her life, no matter what she goes through. So for somebody like that, at Christmas time, I'll say, Miss Alberta, don't pay me rent for this month. You've been such a great tenant. So those are the various things that we do from them. Plus, as I state, you know, if the children need anything, then I'm there. And I love little girls and little boys. So if I go into Costco and see something that I want to dress them in, I'll do that as well.
Yeah, I mean, what made you want to do better for the people moving into your properties? Because that is, you know, unfortunately, it's not the norm. Most people are like, I want to make my money. I need my money. That's it. End of story. Where you say, like, I want to take care of people. I want to see people succeed. I want to do better for the community.
Well, you know what? As I say, I grew up in the Christopher Columbus Projects in New Jersey, where drug abuse and violence was the norm. And so I've been where some of them have been. And we should all strive to get out of where we've come. So the great, as I said to you, half of my portfolio are subsidized tenants. And so I want them to do better and be better, because we can all help one another. They can change their financial trajectory, and they can change their community. And so that's what I'm about as well. I want to be able to be a blessing to others. I've been blessed, so I have to pay it forward. And I'm here to be a blessing to others. And so if I can just change one person's life, then I think I've done good. And so I just have to be there for others. I want, and especially those in my community, I want them to see that there's good people all around. And many of us are not there just for the money. We're there to help change their lives. And this is one of the ways that I can find to do that.
Well, and you're certainly doing it. I mean, in ways I've never even heard of before, like you said, with this grandparents project, I didn't even know that there was like a portion of the population where grandparents are raising grandkids as a common thing. I always thought that's like, oh, that's very unusual. And it's not, which is heartbreaking.
Well, and not only that, it's in the world now. It's not even just in the nation. It's in the world that grandparents are raising their grandparents. Unfortunately, there's opioid addiction all over the world. It's just not in the United States. There's mental health issues all over the world. It's not just in the United States. There may not be as much crime as there are, but there's crime just about everywhere. And especially in the urban areas, they're shooting. As a matter of fact, I went out yesterday morning, headed to church, and there's a bullet hole in my car from my driveway. So, and as you well know, Baltimore is one of the areas where there's a large amount of crime. In New Jersey and Patterson, in my hometown, there's a large amount of crime. And so we're all impacted. We're all impacted by that. And as I said earlier, grandparents that are raising their children, and they're also saving over millions of dollars, because if they didn't take these children, they would have to go into foster families. And then so many of the grandparents that are taking over their children, only 11% of them own their own homes. So many of them also live in poverty. So that is one of the reasons why we're taking on that as well.
Well, and your properties, you know, from what you've sent me and what I've read, are not just like what you'd call bare bones apartments. These are apartments that have like, you know, extremely nice quality of living to them.
Absolutely. I don't care if you're a Section 8 person or if you're a market rate person. You're going to get the granite countertops. You're going to get the stainless or the black appliances. I don't do white appliances in any of them. You're going to get either the laminate floors or the hardwood floors. And if the hardwood floors are already in the property when I purchased them, what I try to do is to bring them back to life. I don't do carpet anymore, because carpet comes with it bed bugs. It comes with it. A lot of the young children now have asthma. And so I don't do the carpet at whatsoever. And then I don't give the basic lighting either. I'm also a personal shopper, so I know how to get those things at the right pricing. And you can go into a Home Depot. I love, it's supposed to be shopping for clothes now. I don't care what city or state I'm in. I'll go into a Home Depot or a Lowe's or any of those right now to see what I can find on sale. I was just this weekend in Home Depot, and they had stainless refrigerators on sale for $588. I'll ask the manager for a discount if I buy five or six of them. And often I get that, because what I often do is I have garages that I don't allow the tenants to have, and I store these appliances in my garages as well. And so even with the grandparents' housing, and we did this with a partnership, they have white cabinets, they have stainless dishwashers. They don't have just the regular electric stovetop stove. They have the low-top stainless stovetop. They have a washing machine and dryer on every floor. And then my tenants in their single-family homes in Baltimore, they get washing machines and dryers in their apartments themselves. And so it was not easy for me to do that when I came into this business, and especially moving to Baltimore. I joined the Baltimore Real Estate Investment Association. I had my male counterpart saying, oh, I don't know why you're doing this. You don't have to do this, and blah, 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 blah. I said, for me, my mantra is, I'm not going to give you anything that I can't live in myself. And then what that does for you is, that gives you a certain type of tenant. I'm by no means a slum landlord, or do I want to be. Your tenant, and I've proven that, will stay with you 10, 15 years. And then what often happens with your subsidized tenants is, say, for instance, if they have a 4-bedroom voucher and they've been with me for 10 or 15 years, of course, the children have gotten older. So what often happens is they cannot, Section 8 will not force them to move out of the property because they're no longer eligible for a 4-bedroom. However, they will, if they remain in that property, they will have to pay additional monies because they're no longer eligible for a 4-bedroom. If they're eligible for a 3 or a 2-bedroom and they want to stay with me, what I will do, and they're my good tenants now, I will buy a property for them, either a 3 or a 2-bedroom, or move them from a 4-bedroom to a 2-bedroom or a 3-bedroom, or even a 1-bedroom unit if I have them available for it.
Well, and I'm not really familiar with, you know, I've heard the term Section 8 before, and I know we've kind of talked about subsidized housing, but I'm not really sure how any of that works.
Okay. So Section 8, and we really shouldn't be calling it Section 8. In one matter of fact, I'm writing a book on that. No, do not call me Section 8. It's called the Housing Choice Voucher Program, and it's throughout the United States. So typically what happens, someone that's in poverty, okay, under a certain income level, if they cannot afford a property, they can go down to their housing, their local housing authority, and try to qualify. Now, what was happening in the past is they were on waiting lists for 10 or 15 years. However, as a result of COVID, it has opened up now. And so they're getting vouchers where they can pay no more than 40% of whatever their rental income. So the government or HUD, who oversees the Housing Choice Voucher Program, will allow them to go to any landlord that will accept them. And not all landlords accept them, because that comes with some preconceived notions, and some of them are true and some of them aren't true. Some consider that everybody will tear your housing up. And once again, I go back, it's to you. You have to set some standards. In other words, I just don't take any Section 8 person that has a voucher. What I do, and you must screen them the exact way that you screen a market rate tenant. So what that means is, for both my market rate and my Section 8 tenants, they must qualify. That means I have to do a credit check. I have to do a background check. I actually go physically see, before any of my tenants move in, how they're living. And I'm doing that unannounced, okay? Because I don't want them to clean up before I actually get there. So I do all of those things. So you have to do that. Now, with the voucher tenants, HUD is either going to pay 100% of their rent and give them money towards their utilities, or anywhere between 50% or more of their rent. I mean, some folks, I just put a young lady in New Jersey in February. She only has to pay $13 towards her rent. There's some that only have to pay $14 and $9 towards their rent, but then they are still responsible for utilities. Now, in a single family property, that means they still have to pay the gas and electric. They still have to pay the water bill. And so that's where many of them get into trouble. I had to actually evict someone that only had to pay $14 a month. And so he didn't pay his $14 a month. And I'm not going to take them for $14 a month every month. So I let it get to $140. But he had not paid his water bill as well. And those are some of the things that you have. And you have to be very wary of and be very careful of. And your leases must be very, very important that you cover all of these things in your lease.
Was that something that can fall back on you because you own the property?
Absolutely. Yes, the water bill can become a lien on my property if I don't pay the water bill. So typically what you have to do is you have to manage that every single month. And if they're not paying the water bill, then you need to be taking them to court for that as well. So to either get them out or to have them pay the water bill so that you can put it in. If they're employed, then you may want to garnish their wages if that's not going to happen. So yeah, your water bill, you don't have to worry about your gas and electric, but your water bill absolutely become a lien on your property, which they can take your property for a tax sale if it's not paid.
That's a really, I mean, I could see at first I was like, well, why wouldn't you? If you're getting paid by, you know, the government program, like what's the difference between that and a normal income? And then I see like, oh, well, because if they don't pay their utilities, it's still your problem. And mm-hmm. you're like, oh, mm-hmm. that's new.
Only the water. They still are responsible for their own gas and electric. And the only thing with that, with the gas and electric, is it's pretty easy for them. They can get assistance, at least one time assistance, just about in every state from the gas and electric if they're unable to pay for it.
Interesting. Well, I mean, we've certainly learned a lot. Are there any other tips or warnings that you usually give people?
Absolutely. First of all, this is not easy. This is not an easy game. So you have to be sure that this is something that you actually want to get in. It can be quite lucrative as well. But I've also been on the other side where I've seen folks lose properties because of their inability to manage it and to manage properly. So the other tips that I would recommend is, number one, always do your due diligence. You want to determine whether or not the property is in a good area, because just because you have a Section 8 tenant, they have the same ideas that we have as well. Most of them want to live in safe neighborhoods. Most of them want their kids to go to good school systems. So these are the things that you should be. You want to be close to transportation. You want to be close to hospitals. You want to just think, what I always say, treat people the way you want to be treated. And would you want to live in a certain area that you're going to be giving your prospective tenants? Those are one of the things. And then everything, it's all about relationships too. You want to build relationships with tenants. You want to build relationships with your banks. You want to build relationships with your credit unions. We have never been turned down whatsoever for any of the bank loans, even when the banks are not giving mortgages, even with in a pretty much situation because of the interest rates right now is to where they are. But because of our relationships that we've established with them, we don't have any problems whatsoever. So I'm going to say, build your relationships, build teams, learn as much knowledge as you would anything. And then your team should consist of a realtor and a good investment realtor, an attorney. You don't just want a criminal. You don't want a criminal attorney. You want a real estate attorney. Think of it when you're choosing a doctor. If you have heart problems, you're going to choose a cardiologist. You're just not going to choose a general MD. The same thing with an accountant and a CPA. You don't just want a general accountant. You want an accountant that's well-versed in the real estate. And then what you want to do is you want to vet your contractors. You want to get, if you have to rehab the property, you want to get 3 or 4 quotes from a contractor as well. And then if you're going to obtain a mentor, you make sure you're a mentor. You vet that. You do your due diligence. Make sure that they're doing exactly what they're saying and they're just not selling you in coaching.
Certainly one of those, like, anyone can give advice, but not everyone can give good advice.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, Janet, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for being here with us today. I wanted to make sure people know where to find you if they're looking to find more from you.
Okay. They can find me at thecashflowdiva.com, or you can email me directly, janet@thecashflowdiva.com. And so, Colton, I just want to thank you. I mean, you are absolutely amazing as well. And I appreciate you as well for having me on.
Thank you for saying that. I've appreciated your time immensely. Thank you so much for being here. Well, it's definitely more dicey than I thought with the rules and penalties, but it also seems like it carries a lot more power for growth on both sides of the situation if you handle it correctly. This is the last week of March, so there's a little time left to change these rankings. Number 1, the United States, led by New York, California, and Illinois. Number 2, England of the United Kingdom. Number 3, Canada, with Ontario neck and neck with British Columbia. Number 4, Australia, with Queensland barely holding out. And number 5, Ireland, hanging in there for the long haul. That's it for this week. Have a great week, a great weekend, and I'll see you all back here for another new episode next week. Until the next episode, please do all those things that help the show grow, like rating, reviewing, liking, and subscribing. Remember, you can reach out to dumbenoughpodcast@gmail.com or on any of the social media pages if you want to reach me personally. Most importantly, stay dumb.